Well, in this part of Focus 580, we will be taking up what is a very basic sort of question. And here is the question. Do people from different cultures think differently? It is a question that our guest this morning, Richard Nisbet, who is professor of psychology at University of Michigan, has looked at, has done research on. And his conclusion is the answer to the question is, yes, people from different cultures do think differently. He has written about this in a great many research papers, and also some of the work has been published as a book that came out, I think, first last year and now is available in a paperback edition. It's published by the Free Press. The book is titled The Geography of Thought, How Asians and Westerners Think Differently and Why. So if you're interested in that subject, you can look for the book. And of course, here on the program, we welcome your questions. All you need to do to be a part of the conversation is to pick up the telephone and call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Professor Nisbet visiting the campus. He gave a talk last night. This was in the MillerCom series. We've had a lot of these folks on our program over the years and are pleased to have him with us. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
For being here. In the book that you write, there would have been a time when you had thought that people, no matter where they lived and no matter how they made their living, whatever they did, the idea was that they all think the same. That's not to say that they don't maybe think different things. That is, they have different beliefs. Their cultures teach them different things. But the way their minds work, the thought process, that's another thing. And you said there would have been a time you would have said, it doesn't matter. People are people. It's all the same. But you got interested in it, prompted, I think, by a colleague or a graduate student. And when you got into looking at it more and more, you came to the conclusion that, in fact, that's not right. People are different in the way that they think.
That's right. There's a very long history in Western philosophy, beginning at least as early as Socrates, which maintains that people think in the same way. That is, they perceive, they remember, they have cognitive processes that are the same regardless of who they are, or what position in society they occupy, and so on. And that's been pretty much the uniform opinion of philosophers ever since in the West. It was that view was adopted by psychologists in the late 19th century. That is, when they first became psychologists, it was a branch separate from philosophy. And it was almost a unanimous opinion of psychologists through the end of the 20th century. And I adopted that opinion. I saw no reason to doubt it. I actually thought about it, but came to the conclusion that there weren't differences in the way people thought. There shouldn't be. I had good theoretical reasons for thinking that everybody should. Sort of notion of software versus hardware. Everybody's got the same hardware, but the software, which governs the way people think, is all the same. And as you say, how I became disabused of that notion was by a rude awakening I got from a graduate student, a very brilliant guy from China named Kai-Ping Peng. And one day, shortly after we'd begun working together, he said, "You know, Dick, there's a difference between you and me. You think the world is a line, and I think the world is a circle." And I said, "Pardon me." He went on to say, essentially, characterize the nature of Western thought as being analytic. That is to say, you look at some salient object, could be a person, and you look at the attributes of it. You try to use those attributes to categorize the object, and you reach for the rules that you assume determine the behavior of that object. And there's a sense of control on the part of Westerners, control of the environment, control of important objects, and so on. In contrast, East Asians, and by that I mean Koreans, Japanese, and Chinese, though the differences may be wider than that, but we certainly believe the differences hold for that group as compared to people of Western European culture. For East Asians, there's a holistic point of view where people look at the world in much broader terms. They look at a particular object in relation to the field that it's found in. They don't pay much attention to attributes of objects by themselves. There isn't much concern with categories. It's relationships between objects in the field and between objects and background that they attend to. And there isn't as much sense of control over the environment or control over the object on their part.
I know another point in the book, I think you relate a story of asking someone who was Asian why he thought there was this sort of difference between East Asians, particularly the people from the cultures and the places that you talk about, China, Korea, and Japan, that are all sort of linked back to China and then to Europeans. And his comment was something like, well, it's because you had Aristotle and we had Confucius.
Right.
Which is an interesting way of thinking about just how much culture is ground in particular kinds of dominant philosophies. Although I think you also make the point of that in fact, Aristotle and Confucius were in a sense, they grew out of their cultures. Mm-hmm. So perhaps the way of thinking about the world and looking about the world predated them, was older. And then, in fact, if you look within the philosophical traditions of both of those major streams, there are people who were different. I mean, there are European philosophers that are more like the Asian ones and Asian philosophers that are more like the European ones. But there are these sort of majority opinions that do seem to be rooted in even older cultural ideas, which I'll get you back to the question, well, why should that be? Why should there be this major sort of difference in worldview between a Chinese and a Greek?
Well, as you're pointing out, these differences, we believe, go back a very long ways, at least to the 5th century B.C., and the best evidence, I should say, that this characterization that this graduate student had of the two major cultures comes primarily from a relatively small group of anthropologists and historians of science and philosophers of science who maintain just those differences existed among ancient Greeks and Chinese, and they point to the differences in philosophy and science, which really back up these kinds of characterizations. For example, Aristotle would look only to the object to explain its behavior. So if he wanted to explain why it was that a stone drops to the bottom and dropped into a basin of water, he would say, well, the stone has the property of gravity. But then there's this problem that if you drop a piece of wood into that same basin, the piece of wood is going to float. And then Aristotle would have explained that by saying, well, the piece of wood has the property of levity. Now, aside from the fact that nothing's been explained by that, it's very clear that what's been ignored is the environment, the medium, and that's characteristic of Western philosophy and science, as compared to Chinese. In contrast, the Chinese had a very good understanding of the notion of action at a distance. So they had a good understanding of acoustics, they had a good understanding of magnetism, and 2,000 years before the West understood the reason for the tides, they understood that it was the moon that governed it. So a very different stance in philosophy and science between ancient Greeks and ancient Chinese. And now you ask the question, why should there have been these differences? That's a historical question, and it's one that I'll attempt to answer, but it's speculative relative to the kind of evidence that I have to talk about contemporary Chinese, contemporary East Asians and people of West European culture. And that has to do with a difference in the nature of social practices and social structure in the two cultures. Ancient Chinese society was highly complex. They lived in a world that was kind of hard to negotiate. They had hierarchies above them, ranging all the way from the local magistrate up to the emperor, and different kinds of obligations. They had complex obligations to the people at the same level as they had in the particular village where they lived, and life required attention to other people. And the notion then is that among people who've thought about this the questions of these differences is that the reason that they thought about the physical world in a different way and the way is the same reason for why they thought about the social world in a different way. You have to pay attention to the social world if you live in a complex world with sharp role requirements. And that your attention there just continues to the physical environment as well. So your metaphysics, that is your understanding of the way the world works, is going to be similar for the physical world as for the social world, and it's the social world that's driving your understanding of the physical world. In contrast, the ancient Greeks had much simpler societies. They were much more individualistic. They had many fewer role relations. And so they had the luxury of looking just to the object, could be a person, that they wanted to have some goal in relation to, and they could ignore the social surroundings to a degree. And to the extent that you're concerned with the object, you want to know its attributes, and it seems useful to have some idea of categories. So you find the Greeks being tremendously concerned with categories, that is, how the one resembles the many. There was no such notion in China of categorization in that sense. They were concerned with the parts of the whole rather than the one to the many that can be described as a category.
Let me introduce again our guest in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Richard Nisbet. He's professor of psychology and is also the co-director of the Culture and Cognition Program at University of Michigan. If you're interested in reading some of his work about culture and the way people think, you can look for the book The Geography of Thought, which is now available in paperback, and it's published by the Free Press. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think probably the differences that you have talked about have now become cultural stereotypes when people make these kinds of comparisons. At least you see that kind of stuff in the popular media if they compare East Asian culture with European culture and by extension also American culture. There we have the idea that to us the idea there's a lot of stress on the individual and on individualism, and that people are raised to think of themselves in a social sense almost as free agents, that what is important is them and what they do in the world and how they as an individual go out and affect the world, and that we're told that in Asia there is a lot more concern with relationships between people. Hierarchies are very important. Family is obviously very important. What other people think of you is very important. And within Asian families, for example, if a child misbehaves and the parent is correcting them, you know, they may indeed say something like, you know, because of your actions, what will people think of our family? What are they going to think of us? Whereas in the Western parent probably would be more likely to say to the child, what are people going to think of you? So I think we're sort of used to hearing that and the idea that those express cultural values and those are the kinds of things that the children, you know, the American kid and the Chinese kid as they're growing up, that's the kind of teaching that they're going to get. But I guess I'm interested in getting at this idea that it's more than it's at a deeper level somehow than that, that it's not just about culture and it's not just about socialization. And how do you get it? How do you get at that deeper level? How do you figure out whether indeed we are talking about not just differences in values and beliefs, but we're also talking about differences in cognitive process?
Okay. That's a great question. Let me first say that I think that the views you just characterize as being stereotypes are, in fact, not understood to the great majority of Westerners. And this is shown by when Western businessmen try to deal with business people, I should say, try to deal with people in business in the East. There are often very deep misunderstandings because of these different understandings of the social world and the nature of the self, so that Westerners want to get down to brass tacks. They say, they shake hands, how are you? Good to know you, Mr. Kiriyama. And then they want to get down to the deal. Here's our proposal. this is regarded as extraordinarily rude and strange by East Asians, who expect to spend quite a bit of time in a kind of social and emotional contact, getting to know one another, building a basis for trust, and they don't know what to make of it. The Westerner, on the other hand, is totally mystified by this insistence on wasting time in the social and emotional get-togethers and trying to understand one another. So I think it's only the rather sophisticated person who has these views about the social differences that you're talking about. But in fact, the cognitive differences, it's not obvious that there would be cognitive differences that would flow from those, but I think the cognitive differences, we know the cognitive and perceptual differences are there, and I can talk about some of that research. But we also know that there are socialization differences that start extremely early that make people quite different in the two cultures. There are a couple of lovely studies, for example, that have this kind of design. They're very simple. You just go into the home of people with 5 to 19-month-old infants, and you give the mother a few toys, and you ask the mother to play with the child as they normally would with these toys. And these particular studies were both done with Japanese and American mothers. And what you find is that the American mothers will say something like, look, Billy, it's a truck. See, it has nice wheels. That translates as, look, Billy, check out objects. Note the attributes. The Japanese mothers don't behave that way at all. They'll say, it's a vroom vroom. I give it to you. You give it to me. Yes, thank you. And the Japanese mothers, and never the American mothers, may take the child's face in their hands and point it to their face, point it to the object, to show the child what is the appropriate reaction to this object and what is the appropriate relation between the mother and the child as they respond to this object. So there's much more socialization toward a focus on the object on the part of the Americans. There's much more focus on the nature of the relationship between mother and child on the part of the Japanese. You find also another early socialization study is on the difference between understanding the world as object versus substance. You can present to people in this particular study, which was by investigators named Imai and Gentner at Northwestern, you can present people with a thing, which is an object made of some substance. For example, a pyramid made of clay, and you can say, or cork, I think they used. And you say, this is my Dax. And then you say to the person, you give them a choice on a tray between something of the same kind of substance, that is pieces of cork, or something that is the same kind of object, that is a pyramid made of, for example, white plastic. And you say, which is your Dax? And if you look at people in their, at babies, in their early twos, you'll find no difference between Americans and Japanese. They're just as likely to choose the object as the substance. But the subjects in this study ranged in age from early two-year-old to middle-aged. And by the time before the age of three, the American kids are pointing to the object as the Dax, implying that they've coded this little part of the world as an object. The Japanese are pointing to the substance as the Dax, implying that what they've coded this thing is primarily a substance. And this difference persists throughout life.
Our guest again this morning in this part of Focus on Vedic, Richard Nisbet, and this is just a little bit of the research that you can read about if you're interested in pursuing this a little bit further in his book, The Geography of Thought, How Asians and Westerners Think Differently and Why. It's now available in a paperback edition published by the Free Press, and of course questions are welcome. What we want to do is just here take a moment or two out from the program, a very short break, because we're coming near the end of our fundraising effort for the spring. So we need to take as many opportunities as we can to remind people of that fact and encourage them to make a pledge. And this would be a great time to do it. We do have a challenge we've mentioned, and after today, there'll only be one more day if people want to pledge during Focus 580 to do that. So maybe now would be a good time to do that. At the very least, at the end of the program, if you'd like to wait, 244-9455 is the number. And again, here joining me in studio is Jack Brighton. He is our Director of Internet Operations.
Right. And your former producer. Don't forget that.
No.
A proud chapter in my life, I must tell you. But I wanted to just add, it's a really good thing that people do think differently. We think that that's an important aspect of our world civilization to explore, and something we do quite a bit on this show. And, you know, we also think that there are different ways to think about how you pay for a radio operation. Some places, they sell advertisements. You have to go through the ads to get to the content. We want to just give you the content, and the price for that is that we ask you a couple times a year to help pay the bills. Right now, you can do that by calling our pledge line, 244-9455. It will literally take a minute of your time, then you can get back to the show, which will resume in a minute or so. And also help us make this challenge, because we have a longtime friend of ours, Barbara Peckham from Peckham & Associates, who will contribute $200 to our pledge total if we hear from 10 people by noon on Focus 580. And so if you will make that pledge call, you'll help us make that challenge. And also we have some of the Dennis Barron cartoons yet to give away. So a lot going on. And we check with Maeve Riley, who's in our pledge center, to see where we stand on the challenge.
Jack, we have to hear from four more callers. There's a caller calling in right now. Oh, we've got one. So we only have to hear from three more people to get that $200 added by Barbara to our pledge total. So give us a call now, 217-244-0025. If you're calling for the very first time, did I give you the wrong number?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, 244. I think that was my personal number.
Is that your own phone?
Yeah, sorry.
Don't call me personal.
Don't
line.
Call me. I'll take the pledge and I'll bring it in here. That's fine. It's 244-9455. Sorry.
That's
give
hilarious.
Us a call now. Sorry.
That's okay. I frequently end up saying the on-air number because I've got that number in my brain.
Oh, you're the one who keeps doing that.
I'm afraid so. Yeah. All right.
217-244-9455. Let there be no mistake. Please call that pledge line now. Thanks.
All right. Thank you both very much. We'll check with you again at the end of the program and continue to talk here this morning, as we have been, with Richard Desbitt from University of Michigan. He's done research in a number of areas. He's looked at things like eating behavior and obesity. He's looked at how it is we think about our own behavior and explain the behavior of others, and this particular issue that we're talking about this morning, how thinking and even perceiving are affected by culture. We have a caller here standing by in Indiana, so let's talk with them on our line four.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
I remember in the 60s when I was a graduate student in philosophy, had some friends who were on the Buddhism trip, and I remember reading some of the Eastern philosophy. It didn't take me too long to realize that I couldn't see much further going into this because it wasn't going to get me anywhere. And I was wondering where mathematics fits in all this. There are a lot of East Asians who do quite well in physics and astronomy, and what is the weight of this thing you're talking about? I mean, is it just prima facie, there it is, but other kinds of thought processes, they're not that way. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing the physics we're doing. Thanks.
Okay.
There are... historically, of course, enormous differences between the way science and mathematics were practiced. There's always been a great paradox to scientists, which is why it was that it was Greeks who invented science, which is essentially rules plus categories, rather than the Chinese, who were light years ahead of the Greeks in terms of technology. In fact, they had technologies that weren't discovered in the West until 1,500 or 2,000 years after the Chinese had. And I think the explanation has to do with this nature of analytic thought, which, by the way, includes formal logic. Formal logic was very much a part of Greek thought Aristotle invented formal logic. Some people say it's because he got sick of hearing lousy arguments in the marketplace and the political assembly, and he said, look, can we agree that if you have an argument that has this structure, it's a lousy argument? That kind of logic was never formalized. There was never much concern with logic at all in China, except for a very brief period in the 3rd century B.C., and logic was never formalized, and logic just dropped out as a concern out of Eastern civilization at that time, not to return until an encounter with the West thousands of years later. If you look at modern people today, of course, we're all very much aware of Asian and Asian American superiority, what appears to be that, in science and mathematics. But there is a real difference, I think, that has to do with the nature of the culture, which affects the way that people think. There is the frequent complaint, for example, that East Asians are not as creative in their thinking as Westerners are. We even have evidence that ordinary people, ordinary Americans and ordinary East Asians, differ in the extent to which they use logic in everyday life. Americans are more likely to reason with in a way that agrees with formal logic, thinking about just the most common, ordinary, everyday life events. Although East Asians are perfectly capable of thinking about formal, abstract elements in a logical way, if you start introducing everyday life elements which tend to throw people off, the East Asians are more thrown off it. By these things than the American subjects are. But there's another very, very striking fact, which is despite Japanese superiority or even domination in all kinds of technological domains, in the decade of the 90s, there were 44 Nobel Prize winners that went to people living in America and only one that went to someone living in Japan. And this can't be explained by funding differences. The difference had to do because they spend half as much as we do on science. Germany spends half as much on science as the Japanese do, and they had five Nobel Prize winners. And the French spend much less even than the Germans do, and they had three Nobel Prize winners. So Westerners seem to excel in a certain kind of creative science. And if you try to look at the reasons for this, it may have to do with the ability to use formal logic and thinking about concrete events. That may play a role. It may play a role that, just a social thing, that there's much more concern with appropriate deference to people. And so money goes to older scientists who are not so agile anymore, rather than to more talented younger scientists. But one thing that's almost certainly very important is the role of debate. Debate is just part of the essence of science. You can't do it. You have to have rhetoric. This is my argument, and let other people tear it down. And that's something that is very difficult for Easterners to do. It's very difficult for me to contradict you if I'm a Japanese or a Chinese without inducing enmity. Because the emphasis on harmony has been a deep, deep part of Asian society from the very beginning, and that carries over even into the scientific domain where it's quite counterproductive. And this is not my idea. This is the idea of East Asian scientists themselves who are bowled over by such a fact, for example, as that two people can be very good friends and attack each other in print.
I have a couple of callers, and I want to get to them in just a second, but I wanted to touch on a point here, I know that what we've been if people have been listening carefully now, they will understand that what we've been talking about is cultural differences and how culture affects the way people think. But I can imagine some people hearing the conversation and thinking, well, you're getting into dangerous territory here because it sounds like you're making some connection between race and intelligence. Ability to think, creativity, I mean, whatever kind of word you want to use, which I know is not what you're doing. That's not what you're talking about. That's not where you're saying that the differences are. And yet, I can imagine some people getting really uncomfortable about this kind of conversation.
Well, to this point in the conversation, I can certainly imagine they would. We know it's not racial because in lots of our studies we look at Asian Americans. Asian Americans are always between Asians and European Americans, usually closer to European Americans and sometimes identical to European Americans. So that just rules out the possibility that race is involved. But it also shows you how very, very powerful culture can be, since we know there's nothing genetic about these differences.
Do you think, I mean, if we can go back and if people are interested in exploring in some depth, there are, as you say, things that are more historical issues, if you want to try to explain something about why it is that Europeans seem to be the way they are and Asians the way that they are. But in some respects, those things have started to change, particularly in the need for, say, you take a country like China that can no longer afford to be as inward-looking as maybe it was a couple thousand years ago. So you would suspect that maybe over time, if those kind of conditions change enough, then if we did these same experiments, say that we did them in 100 years, we could go a few generations maybe, you might see fewer differences between Europeans and East Asians. Have you thought about whether, and I know that you have because you address it in the book, whether in fact there will be greater divergence? Are people going to become more different, or will there be some convergence, and will in fact they become more alike?
Well, I think the betting is on our becoming more alike. Of course, the East has been westernizing for over 100 years now. But it's clear that the West is now Easternizing, and that's been true for 20 or 30 years. Our caller mentioned that he knew lots of people who were into Buddhism, as they would have said at that time. Let me admit my age, as we would have said at that time. And that's, I suppose, the beginning of Easternization in the West. But it's become so routine now, the kind of activities of Eastern martial arts for younger people, cuisine, and even much more important things, such as practice of medicine. In the West, there's been surgery for thousands of years, and that would always have been just anathema to an Easterner. It seemed incredibly naive that you could cure someone by removing some object from the body. That would just seem a bizarre concept, since it would have been clear to them that health was systemic, that you're looking at the whole organism and you're looking at the organism in relation to the environment. Now, of course, they were wrong about surgery, because sometimes surgery does turn the trick, but Western medicine has been wrong about the way that you can look just at the object in isolation. That is, just the person in isolation, or the body part just in isolation. Even mainstream medicine now has become much more holistic, much more aware of the need to look at the whole person, much more aware of the need to look at the environment that the person inhabits.
Let's talk with some other callers here. They are in Urbana. First is line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to talk about a little bit about how language affects how people think. And I think that could tie in a little bit with the previous hour's topic, because that was talking about language. Mm-hmm. But I know that in a lot of languages, their inanimate objects are given a gender, considered either male or female. And like in Spanish, you have él and ella. In French, you have il and elle. And so a lot of languages don't even have the word. You know, the equivalent of the English word it. And so it seems like that could change how people think of things. In Spanish, I know there's for the verb to be, there's actually two words. One is if you want to say you are something, you are hungry, or you are a person, in Spanish there would be two words. One of them is tu es and the other is tu eres. And one of those verbs means you are currently, and the other means you are intrinsically. And so the Spanish kind of have this thought of as a condition being temporary or another condition being permanent, and that an American, or not an American, but an English speaker wouldn't necessarily be thinking about. And then another example is that English, on the other hand, has a lot of really good tenses, verb tenses, that another language, a person who speaks another language might not think about. We have, like, you can say you did something. You can say you have done something. You can say you had done something, which means that not only is that in the past that you did something, but it was in the past at some previous time. So that's something where an English speaker can actually think kind of in a very complex way about, you know, a whole bunch of events, you know, happening before or later or whatever, that people with other languages wouldn't think about. And I guess let me just give one more example, which is Russian is an example of a language that doesn't even have determinants. So if in English you might say this is a book, or get me a book, or get me the book, but in Russian you doesn't even have those words. You would just say get me book, or this is book. So anyway, that just seems like that would affect how people think just from the language structure.
Well, there's been a lot of speculation about the relationship between the way people think, Easterners think and Westerners think, and the nature of the languages. And it's really remarkable how many of the language differences map onto the cognitive and perceptual differences. One of the big differences, for example, is attention to context in language. You pay the context is well. We've done an experiment in which we've shown people scenes, underwater scenes, and we ask them to tell us what they've seen. American subjects go immediately for the most salient objects. They say, "Well, I saw what looked like a trout swimming off to the left." Japanese subjects are much more likely to say, well, I saw what looked like a stream. It was green. There were rocks on the bottom. And these are really huge differences. And there are language differences which map onto this. The common way of saying something is to emphasize the object or the activity first in English, and I presume most Western languages. So you say, skiing is good here. The Japanese colloquial way of expressing that notion would be to say, this place, skiing is good. So you talk about context first in Japanese. You have different words, including verbs, when you're talking, when you're invited. If a Chinese student were to invite a professor to eat, he would use both different words for you than he would inviting a classmate, and he would use different words for dinner. We don't have those kinds of distinctions in our social relations to the same degree as Easterners do, and we certainly don't have those kinds of distinctions in our language. There are many, many examples like that, and there are people who have tried to explain cognitive differences along the lines that we talk about by saying, well, look, the languages are different, and the languages are driving these differences. That's quite unlikely to me. I don't think language is powerful enough. I think the social differences, they seem very powerful to me, and I think it's very plausible that they would be influencing the way people think. What's the role of language? I don't know. There may be some causal role. To me, it's much more likely to be a reflection of the social and cognitive differences rather than something that's driving the bus here. But it may well keep the cognitive and perceptual differences in place. So it may be something that these languages differences may support and help to continue the cognitive and perceptual differences.
Okay, I'll just make one more comment and hang up then. Maybe that makes sense, that maybe the language is a reflection of the culture. And maybe one last example is just that, you know, a lot of people know Eskimos have like 10 or 12 different words for snow. And so that would, of course, be a product of their environment instead of a cause of it. So anyway, I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We'll go on here. Next caller is line number 2 in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I'm glad to hear you saying that you think language more a reflection of the culture than vice versa. Having studied linguistics for some time, I think that makes sense. In fact, I'm convinced it does. I would also like to comment on that last comment by the other speaker, the Eskimo language. It turns out that this is something of a myth. Someone back in the 40s, I think, wrote something about the Eskimos having, I believe it was four different words for snow, and it was in a different context altogether. It was misquoted by the Wharfian, and not by Worf or Sapir, but by their followers, until it reached a point of, I believe, the Eskimos having some 15 different words for snow. It turns out none of them spoke any of the Inuit languages, and none of them had any real knowledge of what was going on. It was altogether false.
All right.
I'm sorry. I just would say I've heard that too, and I was very sad to hear it. That's always been one of my favorite facts.
Yes, it's a very nice story. It's almost a shame it doesn't turn out. I'm a little troubled by what it seems to me in your work, distinguishing between underlying cognitive process and cultural influence. I don't think there's any question about the way Europeans use language and the way Easterners use language. The propriety of coming right to the point for an American or an Englishman or a Frenchman is quite different, say, from a Farsi speaker or an Indian or Chinese. But you could also find this in certain rural areas. You wouldn't come right to the point, at least 100 years ago in a rural farming community, if you were about to buy a horse, you'd discuss a whole lot of other things and then finally come to the question of the horse's price.
Right. Well, I take it for granted that that's true.
Having grown up in a rural community, I saw some of the later stages of that, yes.
Right. And I think it was more true historically in this country, and probably more true in rural areas. I mean, I think historically, in some ways, the West, certainly America, was much closer to the East. There were, especially if you look at standard agricultural communities, they did have something like the kind of complexity and requirements for role relations in a wide variety of ways that were more characteristic of the East. So I think that the West, and especially America, has been moving ever further in a Western direction. And socially, we've moved away in the last 100 years from something that's more common, probably worldwide, but certainly in East Asia.
I would like to propose something. In the 50s, there was a linguist, Kaplan, who proposed that Westerners and Easterners wrote in a different way. And he said Easterners write in a circular mode, Westerners write linearly. I don't think that's too respected any longer. He claimed this was based on their mental process. It seemed to me from the beginning that it was really a matter of adopting different tactics for writing, that rhetoric isn't necessarily a reflection of mental process. It's a way you organize the result of the mental process. And so if you describe a great deal of Western rhetoric, it does seem lineal. Although if you look at somebody like James Joyce or Virginia Woolf, you see a very circular process.
Right. Well, I think that's an extremely interesting point. I do think there are profound differences in thought that are affected by rhetoric. In the West, we just take it for granted. In science and the law and all kinds of domains, even in arguments between spouses, that there is a certain form of rhetoric that you use. And the normal thing is to say you talk about the problem area, you talk about some of the broad theories, you talk about your specific theory, and then you talk about your specific hypothesis. You say how are you going to test that, and you present your evidence about it, and you show how it proves your point of view, and you argue against other positions that might be taken against you, and then you wind up with conclusions and recommendations. And we start people along that line in nursery school. So you bring in your lovey into class, and you say, why is it that you like this? He says, well, I like my elephant because. And we learn this kind of rhetoric of explanation very early on, something which is not characteristic of the East to nearly the same degree. And that form of rhetoric, I think it does influence our thinking. I mean, it certainly influences my thinking as a professional psychologist. I mean, I know I'm going to have to communicate that way, so I think that way.
We have a number of other callers, and I'd like to try to get at least one more. And again, I want to thank the last caller for his comments. The next person in line is in Urbana, and line number 3. Hello?
Line 3?
Yes.
I would like to get back to the example your guest cited of Nobel Prizes as an indicator of cultural differences in creativity. One of the examples he gave before that was that the technology in China, for example, was far more advanced well before Western logic was born. Seems to contradict his example that culture has anything to do with creativity. The other comment I have is that the Nobel institution itself is a creation of Western logic, in which very specific and narrow research is rewarded, whereas larger concepts, example being the peace nonviolence initiative of Mahatma Gandhi, which never resulted in any Nobel Prize, but people like Arafat and Kissinger and whatnot received Nobel Prizes. So what I'm getting at is that citing an example like the Nobel is not a very good way of comparing cultural creativity. One more comment, and I'll hang up and listen. And that is, if you look at the medicine today, the mind-body connection in medicine was the mainstay of Eastern medicine. Only now we are beginning to realize, and I think if that's not an example of creativity, I don't know what is. So I agree with David in that your guest may be treading into a very dangerous field, because we already have thousands and thousands of Asians working in scientific institutions in this country doing excellent work, but not getting as many Nobel Prizes as they might deserve. So I'm not sure that has anything to do with culture. It may have something to do with the way society and the world is structured today.
You raise several excellent questions, and unfortunately we don't have a lot of time to deal with them, because they're certainly worth several minutes. But can you take a couple of minutes and make some comments?
Okay, I'll wait for your sign to tell me I have 10 seconds left. Well, I think there are a very large number of very interesting questions which are just raised. I certainly acknowledge that creativity, it takes many forms. Scientific influences by the East on the West. Niels Bohr, who was one of the greatest of 20th century physicists, has attributed his work in large part to his understanding of Chinese philosophy. And which includes, by the way, an appreciation of contradiction. Western logic requires that A and not A are completely incompatible. One must be true and the other must be false. And, of course, quantum theory says, oh, actually, one can be true and not true at the same time. An object can be both here and elsewhere at the same time and so on. This is just anathema to Western thinking. We just can't do that. And Bohr attributed his success in doing that to his knowledge of Chinese thinking. Leibniz also had a great deal of contact with Chinese thinking by way of the monks who lived in the emperor's court. And Leibniz made use of it in his thinking, and it became part of the dialectic of Hegel and then ultimately of Marx and Engels. Now, if I'm to the extent that I'm treading on the worry that I may be treading on dangerous territory here, I should say that whenever I talk about this and there are East Asians in the audience, they're sitting there and nodding and smiling. I'm being told that the book is being assigned in courses now, and I'm told the reaction of East Asians, just like I see when I give the talk, is one of validation. There's an assumption. They come to this country. They know they think differently than other people. They don't know quite how, and they feel that it's devalued or that it may be devalued. And what this book shows is, no, they're it's not an inferior way of thinking. It is indeed a very different way of thinking, and you can expect different kinds of good things to come from it. And it would be absurd to say that one way of thinking is better than the other. Mm-hmm.
So much more to be said, but we're going to have to finish there. If you would like to read more on this subject, you should look for this book that we've mentioned. It's titled The Geography of Thought by our guest, Richard Nisbett. It's published by the Free Press. Richard Nisbett is professor of psychology, University of Michigan. Thank you very much.
Thank you.